This episode of the Memory Palace is brought to you by Progressive. Progressive helps you compare direct auto rates from a variety of companies, so you can find a great one, even if it's not with them. Quote today at Progressive.com to find a rate that works with your budget. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. This is the time in the calendar when I take a little break and I re-release my favorite episode from the previous year. I have been doing this for the past several, and I enjoy the exercise of looking back on a year's worth of work. And for the second year in a row, I've noticed that this odd COVID era has messed with my sense of time. I'm pretty sure I am not alone in that. But I go over the list and I keep saying, wait, that was this year? Or wait, I totally forgot that one. Or moreover, that the memory of my writing it has become so vague. Feels like a half-remembered dream. So maybe that's why this year's favorite episode, which doesn't ever really mean favorite, but maybe that's why this one was so clear to me. Because I remember all of it. It came to me in a rush. It just kind of flowed. I knew where I wanted to go and how the scene should play out and how the different sections should feel when you got there. And as I moved through the story, I kept finding that it was all working, which is not usually the way it goes. And I just felt in control of things, which is rare both in the work that I do and in the world that we lived in. And it was fun and it felt good. And I think it's a good story. And so in a second, you will hear that story, my favorite of the year. If you like it, do take a second out to share it. Maybe there is a friend or relative who you wish you could be seeing right now, but can't. And maybe they would like it too. And to you, may you have a happy and healthy new year. I'll talk to you again. This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. She had never been tested. She knew she was fast, but what was fast? I mean, she was faster than the kids in the block. They couldn't catch her in tag. And she could beat all the other girls at the races they held at the church picnics. She had the ribbons to prove it, though the cake she'd won that one time was long gone. But they were girls, in the Chicago suburbs in the 1920s, and believe me, I do not mean to offend here, and I'm pretty sure Betty Robinson wouldn't want to either. But there was so little in the culture of the time that was encouraging any of those girls to try to be fast, to learn to run, or just want to win. Sewing, music, art, cake making. Distinguish yourself there, but leave sports to the boys. The roar of the Roaring Twenties hadn't quite reached Riverdale, Illinois. So Betty was fast, but sure. Okay. She was a lot of things. She was also good at sewing and playing the guitar and the piano. She was in all the plays, had real stage presence apparently, had this smile that shone all the way to the back of the auditorium. People called her Smiling Betty, which is a quaint and kind of silly thing to be known as, but also what could be better? To be known as the kid, the teenager, no less, who just seemed to enjoy life. She was a sophomore in high school and thinking about her future. She probably couldn't afford college on her dad's salary at the brick factory, but she could probably teach. Not an academic subject. All those teachers were male, but music, or art, maybe sewing. She was good at a lot of things. It would be hard to decide. She was just one of those people. The kid parents would tell really had something, but what? They would tell her she was talented, but like, how talented? How could she know in her small town if those talents had never been tested? One day, Mr. Price, her biology teacher, is sitting on the L train waiting for it to take him home after school. There's a frigid wind off the lake, and he is happy to be warm inside the train car. His breath fogs up the glass. He wipes it away with his gloved hand and sees down below bundled up students trudging through the snow. And from the back of the pack, he notices one of his own students running for the train. One of the girls. Betty, the one who's always smiling. Nice kid. And she is really going for it. But the train is already starting to rumble back to life. She's got a couple of hundred yards and a staircase to navigate. So she is going to be waiting for the next one. No chance she's making this one. But still, she's going for it. You had to admire her spunk, if not her ability to solve for time by estimating her speed and the distance to the train, but that's not his fault, he wasn't the physics teacher. So he watched this charming girl make a go of it, all flailing arms and seemingly oblivious to her certain impending failure. And he turns to his paper as the train started to lurch and pull away. Then something plops onto the seat beside him, a biology textbook. He looks up and there, smiling, hardly winded, is of course Betty. He is dumbfounded. He is also the track coach. Betty Robinson stands in an empty hallway after the last bell behind a line written on the tile in white chalk. Her biology teacher stands behind another chalk line, a precisely measured 50 yards away. Behind her, a boy, a cute one, a senior from the track team, sighs, looking at her all wrong shoes, at the awkward way she crouches at the starting line. She hadn't even known you crouched at the starting line. Mr. Price holds up his stopwatch and blows a whistle, and Betty runs. It isn't pretty, her form is ridiculous, but it is fast. She crosses the line 6.2 seconds after she started, which is 1/10 of a second faster than the women's indoor world record at the time. They talk. He asks her if he can sign her up for an amateur race. It's just a few weeks away. Just a quick L ride into the city. She says sure. He doesn't tell her that it is one of the most prestigious competitions in America, and that the current world record holder will be there. And so for the next weeks, he and the cute senior, Betty found the cute senior to be a real sweetener in the whole deal, taught her everything they could about how to run, how to rein in those flailing arms, how to anticipate the starting gun, how to push off the blocks, how most racers are won and lost in those first few seconds. Taught her about track conditions, about wind, about anything that they thought they could cram into what little time they had. And then she lined up at Soldier Field in Chicago, a few steps away from the fastest woman in the world. And she tried to remember all that, but how was she supposed to remember all that? And then she was running and running and running, and it felt incredible. She came in second, and it felt incredible. And she was invited to join the Illinois Women's Athletic Club, where the victor herself trained, and the place was a kind of paradise to 16-year-old Betty Robinson. Not only was it kind of a clubhouse with a cafe and a steam room and a pool and a library, it was filled with women who were like none she had ever met, who were proud of being fast and strong. The 20s were roaring there, and these were the women who were making the noise, who were declaring that there were new ways that women could be, testing the upper limits of athletic achievement and hemlines and alcohol consumption. It felt incredible training in the company of these women, of testing herself every day, against the best. And soon she was on a train across the country for the first time, seeing New York for the first time, breaking her first world record, though a too strong wind would keep it off the books. And then, not even a year into her career as a four-wheel runner, onto the Olympic trials, where she doesn't win, but she doesn't need to. She is plenty fast enough to qualify. And then she is on an ocean liner, bound for Amsterdam, and she is a junior in high school. And it is incredible. She meets people from all over the country. She runs in the sun on the top deck of a ship in the middle of the Atlantic. She runs to the pool each day to see Johnny Weissmuller, the most perfect man she could ever conceive of, swim laps. She swoons each time he passes by at lunch. The games begin and the Americans start losing. If this were a movie, this would be the part where a montage would roll. America's male track stars, men we had met in brief on the boat, surely, start coming up short again and again. One stumbles at the starting line. Another kicks dirt in defeat. A handsome, lithe sprinter, legs and arms pumping, square jaw set, an American flag embroidered on his shirt, doesn't see a fleet-footed Finn coming into frame behind him and blowing right past him. And then the women, the ones we'd seen beat Betty back home in Chicago and at the Olympic trials, they start dropping like flies, pushing desperately to overtake their opponents, but their faces falling as the tape breaks ahead of them. Exhausted women with their hands on their knees, another on her back in the gravel, the agony of defeat. But then there is Betty, winning her first heat, and then another. And then the montage ends, and she's shaking out her arms on the track, bouncing on her heels, We see the faces of her competitors, grim and determined. The different flags on their shirts, none of them American. She is the only one. A girl among grown women. Some announcer, some reporter, someone tells us that 16-year-old Betty Robinson of Riverdale is the nation's last hope to salvage this disastrous meet. Not much hope, to be honest, but let's see what the kid can do. And what she does is crouch into the blocks and put her head down and go to work. I cannot tell you what it is like in that world, that place where the elite athlete's mind goes when she is going flat out, when her body is doing things that ours cannot do. I do not know the din of thoughts or the quiet. I don't know which it is or if it's both all at once. I cannot tell you if time slows down the way it sometimes does when you are truly present, when your senses are heightened, or if it's all a blur, a blink, a breath, and it's done. I can tell you that she won, barely beating a Canadian competitor, by inches, if that. She became the first gold medalist in the women's 100 meters, the fastest woman in the world. I can tell you she was mobbed by her teammates and coach. I can tell you she smiled. There were parties in the hotel and on the boat back home. There was a crowd waiting on the docks. There was a parade in her hometown. General MacArthur, before his own star turn, gave her a gold bracelet. Other admirers, before the Olympic Committee set up rules prohibiting it, gave her diamonds and pearls and beautiful things she'd never imagined she'd own. She was an overnight celebrity. Not just the new favorite all-American girl, but a new kind of girl. An athlete. And then summer ended and she went back to high school. She spent the next years preparing to defend her gold medal in Los Angeles at the 1932 Olympics. She had her first boyfriend. She enrolled at Northwestern. She would sometimes drive out to her uncle's farm and go flying with her cousin in a biplane. She was asked by the newspapers whether she was one of those young women who smoked and drank and went carousing till all hours, and she said, of course not. And she was lying. She was having the time of her life. And one summer afternoon, she was training, and it was just miserable, one of those sticky Midwestern swelters. So she figured she'd hit up her cousin Will for a ride in his plane. The breeze and the altitude just might break the heat. So they went up, as they'd done a bunch of times before. She'd even bought a helmet with the goggles, just like the one she knew Amelia Earhart wore. And so they swooped and soared over the fields and the Calumet River. And the air was cool in her face. And she smiled. And I can't tell you what goes through your head when you are crashing. In the seconds when you don't know what's gone wrong, but you know that it's bad. I don't know if time slows down or rushes forward all at once. I can tell you the only thing she remembered was clouds. Whatever happened between that moment looking up at the sky and the one when she woke up in a hospital bed with pins in her legs and her arm in a cast and her face all cut up after weeks spent in a coma. I can tell you she remembered clouds. The doctors told her she might not walk again, and if she could, she wouldn't be able to run. Her legs were now different lengths, by almost an inch. And they were so sorry. Betty had a favorite brother-in-law. His name was Jim. He fought in France in World War I and came back kind of messed up. He had been gassed in the trenches and his lungs were never the same. It would kill him in the mid-1930s, but before that, he helped Betty Robinson walk again. Some days she couldn't get up at all. She couldn't even straighten her legs. It would hurt too much or they just wouldn't comply. So Jim would scoop her up and carry her downstairs and wait for the cars to pass by, the fastest woman in the world in his arms. And then he'd walk across the park and put her on a bench and she'd sit outside for a bit, get some air and listen to the birds, the wind and the leaves, watch the kids play tag. But the next day he'd stand her up. She'd put her hands on his shoulders and she'd take a step. Maybe the next day she couldn't get up at all. Maybe for the next two. But then she would. And then he'd stand with just one hand on her shoulders. And then with a hand on her back. And then just hovering above it as she took her steps on her own. It went like that. Take a few steps, then try for more the next day. It was okay if she couldn't. She could try again tomorrow. And then more. And then once around the park. And then two. Let's try for two. She could jog months later. After so many mornings in the park, she still couldn't even bend over all the way. But she could run a pretty good clip some days. I read about this part of Betty Robinson's life, when she is pushing through and working to get to half of what she once was, if that. I read some of her recollections reflecting on that time of her life, and she said she was surprised to find how comfortable she was in this changed body, despite the pain, despite the slowness of her progress. She thought it might have been because her head was in such a different place too. She felt like a different person than she'd been before. She had changed, so wasn't it natural that that different person should have a different body? And when I read that, I find that the image that I've had of her in my head has started to drift. There is something in that idea, in her framing of her own self-conception, that sounds like anyone who has come to terms as best as they can with aging, of living in a body that is changing, that can't quite do what it used to do, at least not how it used to. And realizing or wrestling with the notion that maybe the person you're becoming won't need all that. Not in the same way. And it turns out that's okay. And when I do, I realize that the perspective of Betty Robinson, sometimes before she died in 1997 at the age of 87, looking back on her life, has taken me too far away from Betty Robinson as she was then, at 22 years old, when she had just been the fastest woman on earth. When she had just been running in the salt air and the sunshine on the deck of an ocean liner in the middle of the Atlantic, had just ridden in the back of an open roadster in a parade through the streets of her hometown, had been smiling on the front pages of newspapers all over the world, had thrown up her arms in triumph, involuntarily. Your arms just do that sometimes. Had bent so someone could place a ribbon with a golden medal around her neck. And now she couldn't even bend over. And now she could just sit at home while another woman won gold at the Olympics in Los Angeles. Which meant she had 4 years to figure out how to get it all back. If this were a movie, and I'll just say it probably should be, you'd want a scene here, the next morning, after that someone else wins the 100, when she realizes how she's going to get it back. Maybe she drops the bracelet that General MacArthur had given her after her victory 4 years before. The one she'd worn every day since, the one that had survived the crash that almost killed her. So maybe it's lying on the floor of her childhood bedroom, amidst all those reminders of the girl she used to be. The ribbons from her church picnic victories, the program from the school play, her guitar, a reminder of the road not taken. And the gold bracelet is there on the floor in a streak of light that comes through the curtains. And she cannot bend to pick it up. She just cannot do it. In what should be her lowest moment, instead gives her the idea that will bring her back to the Olympic podium. And the idea is real, even if how she came to it and when is collapsed and imagined and made clean and clear for this movie here in her heads. But at some point she realized that she would never be able to win the 100 meters, even if she could run fast enough, even if she could find the right training method or the right shoes that could correct for the ineffable fact that her legs were now two different sizes. She would never be able to leap out of the blocks because she could never get down near the ground to do it because she couldn't even bend over. So what if she didn't have to? Pick your favorite young actor, whomever you want, and cast her in the role of Betty Robinson. Put her in her costume, shorts and a knit shirt, a billowy thing, entirely impractical, nothing like they wear now, something that will create wind resistance, that will literally slow her down, all because of her era's ideas about modesty and gender. Find a metaphor in that if you'd like. Find her on the track at the Olympic Stadium in Berlin in 1936. Find Hitler in the stands. Find Jesse Owens stretching out somewhere on the sidelines. He looks up to watch Betty. All eyes are on Betty. The comeback story. One of the first. She is standing on the oval with her hands stretched out. waiting to take the baton from another American woman. She is the second leg of a four-person relay. It is her only event. It is the only one she can run because it is the only one that won't require her to bend at the waist. Stay in her point of view as her teammate charges toward her, her arms pumping. Her form is perfect, majestic. She is running neck and neck with a German woman beside her. She stretches out and the baton is in Betty's hand and she is off. She is running. She is all effort. There is nothing easy in her stride, but there is joy. She keeps pace with the woman beside her. The woman chosen to bury Betty. Chosen to seize this leg of the race to put distance between the German women and the American women. But she only beats Betty to the next relay by a few steps. Betty has done what she needs to do. Done all that she could hope to do. She has done so much. And she watches as her teammate tries to make up that lost step and as the German woman, still a step ahead, drops the baton. And victory is inevitable. Though nothing about it was inevitable at all. And the tape breaks and Betty runs, as best as she can, to join her teammates at the finish line. They are in each other's arms, and the camera finds the faces of the people that Betty loves the most. Her parents, her doctors, her brother-in-law Jim, just a few years before his death, but they don't know it yet. He is beaming. So are her coaches, who maybe didn't believe she could do it until she proved them wrong. The Hollywood ending she deserved, that is true. It is that cinematic. She is that heroic. Tape a photo of Betty Robinson above your workstation. You could do worse for inspiration. In just a bit, a whistle is going to blow. And the story will end 12 seconds later, which is the shortest time Betty Robinson ever took to run 100 meters in competition. It will go very fast. And since we can have no idea about what filled her mind during that time, we are free to fill it as we will. We can think of her at 16, in a body just figuring out what it is capable of doing, where it is capable of bringing her. Or at 25, in a body trying to figure out just how far it still might take her. We can think about what she might have been thinking. Whether she was thinking at all, was she focused on her breath, or the fall of her feet, or of merely not falling? Were there voices in her head, of her coach, or her own, voices of doubt or elation, that this is happening? That I am winning. I am winning. I am winning. And she is 16 and this is the first time. Or she is 25 and this is the last time. And it is fine. She knows what she is capable of. She has been tested. Ready. Set. This episode of the Memory Palace was written and produced by me, Nate DeMayo, in July of 2021. This show gets research assistance from Eliza McGraw. The show is a proud member of Radiotopia, a network of individually owned and operated podcasts, carrying the flag for independent media in a landscape of corporatized, venture capital-funded, big money thrown around tryhards. It is a product of PRX, a not-for-profit public media company. If you enjoy the show, I am asking you to do the single best thing you can do to support it, and that is tell people about it. Send them your favorite episode. Pick up their phone when you're at dinner or hanging out at their house and subscribe them to the show. Just pick it up, say I'm going to do this thing, you'll thank me later, and just do it. In these times when there are so many choices and so many niches and so many bubbles, it is easy to forget sometimes that the things that we're into, you just kind of assume that they're a big deal in the wider world and everybody's talking about it, and I am here to attest that they are not. If you would like more people to do that, if you want more people to feel the way that you might about the Memory Palace, help them first know about the Memory Palace. Meantime, you can follow me on Twitter or Facebook at the Memory Palace, and you are always welcome to drop me a line at nate@thememorypalace.us. I will talk to you again.
Radiotopia.